I'm Ross Reynolds. On November 14th, 2015, I got a chance to sit down with actor Rainn Wilson. He's best known for his role as the punctilious Dwight Schrute on The Office.
ID badges are long overdue. Security in this office park is a joke. Last year, I came to work with my spud gun in a duffel bag. I sat at my desk all day with a rifle that shoots potatoes at 60 pounds per square inch. Can you imagine if I was deranged?
Babies are one of my many areas of expertise. Growing up, I performed my own circumcision.
Wow, these people here. There's too many people on this earth. We need a new plague.
Smile.
No.
I never smile if I can help it. Showing one's teeth is a submission signal in primates. When someone smiles at me, all I see is a chimpanzee begging for its life.
Rainn Wilson as Dwight Schrute on The Office. He's written a new memoir called The Bassoon King, My Life in Art, Faith, and Idiocy. I spoke to Rainn Wilson about his links to Western Washington and the influence the Baha'i religion has had on his life. Rainn Wilson was born in Seattle. His parents were living on a houseboat on Lake Union. He grew up in Western Washington and attended Shorecrest High School, where he played the bassoon in the band. Rainn Wilson went to the University of Washington, living next door to Dick's Drive-In in Wallingford. Rainn Wilson's parents were Shay Cooper, a yoga teacher and actress, and Robert G. Wilson, a novelist, artist, and business consultant. I started by asking him about the influence his parents had on his life as a performer.
Boy, that's a tough one. You're starting with a fastball down the middle. Let me see. Well, my parents influenced me in a lot of ways, some good, some bad. My mom took off when I was 2 years old. She was doing theater in Seattle in the late 60s, experimental theater. And my dad lived on a houseboat in Lake Union. My dad was a painter. He wrote science fiction books on the side. So they were certainly very artistic. So I definitely got their artistic bohemian genes, that's for sure. And the divorce or, losing a mother at the age of two, I don't know exactly what effect it had on me, but, none good. That certainly has an effect on a person, too. So there's a lot of influences, artistic and otherwise.
You relate how you didn't even know your mother had acted until you were quite older.
Yeah, I was in my early 20s when I found out that she was an actress.
And why was it unknown?
My family is very strange. They're incredibly uncommunicative. They don't really talk about things, especially uncomfortable things. They just don't give them voice, which is why I like to talk about uncomfortable things and give them voice so directly. I don't know. They never, growing up, I asked my dad my whole childhood, why did you guys get a divorce? And he just said, oh, we just went our separate ways, I guess. He didn't say, oh, your mom was having an affair with a theater director in a play she was doing, and she left us when you were 2 years old, which is what I would have preferred to have heard. What were we talking about?
Your parents' influence on your career.
Yeah.
But you didn't even know your mother had been an actress until you were already deeply involved in acting.
That's right. And so when I did find out, when they did reveal that truth— It was kind of perplexing, and I realized, because when I started acting, my dad was a little weird about it. He loved me doing the arts. I mean, he was happy that I was a bassoonist. He was happy that I was interested in drawing and all the kinds of arts that I liked doing. But when I started acting, I could tell he was a little bit hesitant, and I didn't know why that was. I couldn't quite figure it out. I couldn't put my finger on it. But later I realized, it's because Shay, my mom, birth mother, had been an actress. And yeah, so I found out about the whole thing much later in life. And then it really did help once I did find out. It kind of put all the puzzle pieces together.
Did you read your dad's science fiction? Were you a science fiction fan when you were a kid?
In fact, here we are at KUOW, and it's right above where the university bookstore is, or used to be, or is.
It's just down the street.
Okay. And we would come there every week, and I would buy science fiction books. My parents, we were very poor growing up, but they had a rule that they would buy me as many books as I promised to read. So every week I would come back with a stack, up to my chin of science fiction paperbacks, and I would read them. And yeah, I read my dad's too. He would write a new science fiction book about every 9 months or so, and I would read it when it was hot off the presses. I was his first reader. I gobbled them up voraciously. They were really pretty terrific.
I was just going to ask that. I mean, being reading all the great science fiction, how does your dad's match up?
Well, you know, he's got some issues around dialogue and characterization, those little things. But his imagination is incredible. And some of the worlds that he created, I don't know how he did it. I'm a pretty imaginative guy. I can't do what he does.
Well, you've got a lot to work on. I mean, you described spending some of your earlier years in Bluefield, Nicaragua. I mean, how did you get there? And I wonder if you could talk about that experience.
Well, when my mom left my dad, he did what every red-blooded American male does who has a giant toddler on his hands. He went down and moved to the Mosquito Caribbean coast of Nicaragua with a 2.5-year-old. So it was pretty crazy. I stayed there till I was 5. I came back to the Northwest. Actually, we settled in Olympia after that. But I spent from, 3, 4, and 5 in Nicaragua. I write about it in the book. It was I describe it as kind of being a fever dream. You know, you don't have so many solid memories of those years. I don't think many people do. But I have flashes and senses and images, in the memory banks flickering around like by candlelight.
You describe when you moved back to Washington State, your family was poor. But as a kid, did you kind of realize that? Did you feel like you were poor?
You know, the only time I remember realizing that was when I went to a kid's birthday party and he got all these presents and these toys and they were just piled up, 20, 25 presents and toys. And I had just never seen so many toys in my life. Did I put it together that we were poor at that point? Not so much, but I knew, like, wow, I don't have what these other kids have, the neighbor kids that have the Gnip-Gnops and the lawn darts and the Rock'em Sock'em robots and all the great toys of the 70s that, you know, I had a couple of books and a remote control car, and that was it.
You write a lot about the Baha'i faith. Interestingly, there's a Baha'i museum just down the street from us.
I heard about that, yeah.
On the second floor there. But for people who don't know what it is, I wonder if you could give a little capsule description and talk about what kind of an influence it's had on your life.
Sure. Well, it's a big thread through the book for me of growing up Baha'i and then leaving my faith, rejecting it, all faith, becoming an atheist bohemian in New York City. And then that kind of long, slow climb back into faith after I found I was pretty lost and pretty unhappy. So the Baha'i faith is a beautiful religion. It's very loving and accepting. It's hard to describe a major world religion in a nutshell, but basically Baha'is believe that there's only one God. There's only one creator. This all-loving presence wants humankind to evolve spiritually. So in order to do this, this loving providence, creative force that runs through the universe, sends down these divine teachers every 500 years or 1,000 years. And you know them as by names like Krishna and the Buddha and Abraham and Moses and Jesus and Muhammad. These are divine teachers speaking for the specific people that they're visiting at that specific time. And Baha'is believe that there is a new teacher that's come, and his name is Baha'u'llah. And Baha'u'llah means the glory of God, and he lived in Persia in the mid-1800s, spent his entire life being tortured in prisons and banished from country to country, but he wrote many hundreds of books and tablets and letters, and Baha'is believe that he's the most recent of these divine teachers whose message is to unify humankind and allow us to progress to our full spiritual capacity.
Some faiths believe that our reward is after death. It's in the beyond. How does the Baha'i faith look at life now on Earth?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I would say both. So the Baha'i faith is all about a kingdom of God, but not a kingdom of God that descends with organs and harps playing, but a kingdom of God do-it-yourself kit, where our role here on the planet is to make it a better planet and serve people and live a good life and try and make the world a better place. Do we leave this physical world at some point? Sure we do. Is the other spiritual universes, dimensions, are they far more glorious than this limited physical one? Yes, they are.
I can totally relate to losing the faith of your youth, but I never went back to my faith of my youth. What brought you back to Baha'i?
Well, it was a curious sensation I had in my mid and late 20s where My beautiful now wife, Holly Reinhorn, we actually met here at the University of Washington in acting class down in Hutchinson Hall down the street. We were together. She's fantastic. We've been together 25 years. And I was working professionally as an actor, which was beyond my wildest dreams. I never thought that this geeky suburban kid from Shoreline, Washington would be working in, you know, off-Broadway and Broadway and tours and regional theaters and working with some really great world-class directors. It was beyond my wildest dreams. And yet I was unhappy. I was deeply unhappy inside. I was unsettled and discontent. And I couldn't figure out why, because that's how happiness is supposed to work in the world.
You get what you want.
Yeah, you work for what you want. You suffer along the way. Once you get it, then you're happy. Well, there I was with what I had always wanted, and I just was simply not happy. It was not fulfilling me. And I was getting into a lot of trouble with drugs and alcohol and a lot of other pursuits that definitely were taking me away from my center. But it started a spiritual journey. So I started reading holy books and attending various churches and meditation groups, and started even joined the Green Party for a while and tried politics for a little bit. I was trying to something to fill that hole, and I went on a search really for God. It's a very long story. It's in my book a bit, but that eventually, after many years, led me back to the faith of my childhood.
Let's go back to Shoreline, Lake Forest Park, where you spend a lot of your time growing up, and you describe yourself as bone-numbingly nerdy, and of course this was way before nerdy was cool. What were your characteristics of nerdiness in the 1970s?
Yeah, I pretty much take the cake. I think I'm the nerd king. I should have been called the nerd king, not the bassoon king.
Same thing, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. I was pimply, A. B, I played the bassoon. C, I was on the chess team. Model United Nations. Computer club, debate club. I played xylophone in the marching band, and the Shorecrest Highlanders wear kilts. So I was a skinny xylophone player in a dress and played Dungeons and Dragons all weekend. So,
did a willingness to do those nerdy things that wouldn't necessarily endear you to large groups of people, was that useful for you as a performer, where you have to have that confidence to do what you want to do and maybe be in weird situations where people are looking at you and be confident about it?
That's an interesting perspective. I'm not sure. I think that, first of all, for a real nerd, I didn't choose these things. Some people have asked me, like, why did you choose to play the bassoon? You knew that was a nerdy instrument. Couldn't you have played a cool instrument? But when you're a super nerd like that, you don't operate that way. You just do what you need to do, you know, and those are the things that I needed to do. I think that the main thing that it gave me when I look back on it is we had a great group of friends, and we watched Monty Python sketches together and Saturday Night Live together and played Dungeons and Dragons. And so we were not worried about being popular. We weren't worried about girls. We weren't worried about social status and moving up the food chain or any of that stuff. It was this weird little stinky petri dish of nerddom where we could just express our humor and our weirdness, and I'm really grateful for that.
Rainn Wilson's talking about his life, about growing up in Western Washington. His new book is called The Bassoon King, My Life in Art, Faith, and Idiocy. You mentioned taking out the bassoon, but in reading your book, it sounds as though you were kind of tricked into getting into the bassoon.
I was roped into it at Kellogg Junior High School.
How'd that happen?
Well, I was a clarinetist, and I wanted to switch to saxophone, so I went to John Law, the junior high school band teacher. His actual name is John Law. Johnny Law was like, you know, the saxophones were cool. You know, my saxophone friends, they would wear sunglasses, and they could wear loud Hawaiian shirts that matched, and they would do that move with the saxophone that Clarence Clemons does all the time, and they could honk it, you know, wah, like Lisa Simpson, and I wanted to be part of that. But he's like, yeah, you know, we've got so many saxophonists right now. He goes, but you know what? There is an instrument that is so unique and cool that you could play. And I was like, what? What's so unique and cool? What could I play? And he's like, it's called the bassoon. And I was like, ooh, sign me up. Oh, absolutely. I'd love to play that, whatever that weird thing is. So I kind of got conned into it. I kind of had visions of like being this unique guy playing this wildly cool instrument that was the equivalent of a lightsaber, and girls fawning and falling at my feet, and none of that happened.
But you stayed with it, and you're on the cover of the new book with your bassoon.
Yes, I did. I call it my nerd crucifix. It's a kind of a badge of honor, and I love that. I love that damn bassoon, and I stayed with it for 5 years. But when I moved to Chicago in my junior year, I know we're skipping ahead here, that's when I discovered acting, and I became a drama geek. I call the drama geeks the lions of the dork Serengeti. They're highest up on the food chain, so that's when I kind of left the other stuff behind.
You describe a lot of moments that kind of propelled you to your performing career. One of them, in 1985, after you saw the movie A Chorus Line, why did it move you so?
You know, I was trying to decide whether to become an actor or not because my dad was kind of a failed artist. He had never really made it professionally. He didn't really undertake a journey to try and make it professionally. He always kind of worked day jobs and supported his family, and for that I'm grateful. But I knew that to commit to being an actor was a huge move. I knew that was like a 10-year commitment, which is really scary when you're 19 years old thinking about making that. And I was trying to decide whether to go to acting school and dive in and try and become the best actor I could be, or go to India with my friend John Valadez, who I'd gone to high school with at Shorecrest. And I was visiting my folks. I was visiting my mom at that point in Boston and really tossing over this. And I stopped into a matinee of A Chorus Line in Boston. And it's a terrible movie. It's considered one of the worst movies of the 80s and the worst musical to film adaptation ever. Don't see it. But you know, A Chorus Line, it's all these struggling actors and artists and like, I really need this job and I really want to make it and I've got a headshot and, you know, all they're dreaming. And I was crying in the movie theater. I was a 19-year-old boy just like crying. And I knew that I had to do it at that point. I knew I had to go full in. And I went out of the movie theater and there was this kind of beautiful transcendent moment where the sun was setting and this red light was streaming through the snowflakes, and it just felt like this peace came upon me, and I was just like, you've got to go for it. You've got to dive in. And that's when I knew I was going to do it no matter what, hell or high water.
And that took you back to Seattle. You attended college at the University of Washington. You lived next to Dick's Drive-In over in Wallingford nearby. Right. And you applied for the UW Professional Actor Training Program. And they rejected you.
They rejected me, yeah.
What was that like?
Well, a bump in the road. It was funny. Yeah, there was a guy, I forget the guy's name, he always wore an ascot. If you're a drama teacher at a college and you wear an ascot, like, I'm sorry, something's wrong with you. That's not how the world works. But he wore an ascot and he rejected me. He didn't understand what this skinny, strange actor, you know, gesticulating in front of him was doing. And but I went on and I ended up getting into the NYU graduate acting program and went to New York. That took me to New York in 86. And it was great for me. It was a great experience.
And you've got a passage in your book where you write about Seattle. Would you share that with us?
Oh, yeah. I have a very tiny ode to Seattle, which I love very much. It makes me laugh. It's about Seattle in the 70s. The city of Seattle was a mossy, shambly town with a dubious history. It was created in the late 1800s by Chief Self, who invented salmon and wisdom. White men settled there because they loved coffee and kayaking and wanted a place to wear their new jerkins of flannel. The world's first indie group was a jug band called Pearl Jamboree that refused representation and would only play late nights at a waterfront bar called Cobain's Pub. Chief Self was noted as saying, "I saw them before they sold out and made all those lame gramophone recordings of 1882. Now everybody likes them." Rolls eyes, puffs on enormous pipe. None of that is remotely true, but it would be a way cooler history than the boring lumber and pioneer-filled one we were all taught in 7th grade Washington State history class. We Seattleites always wanted the city to be where it eventually ended up, which is not such a good thing in retrospect. Be careful what you wish for. It was a backwater in the 70s, famous only for the film It Happened at the World's Fair, with Elvis Presley as a crop-dusting pilot dancing under the Space Needle with a little Chinese girl and wooing a forgettable, pretty young nurse with his guitar. As a city, we couldn't get any respect back then, even with the 1979 world champion Supersonics. We just wanted people to like us. We wanted to be San Francisco. How come everybody in the world loves San Francisco and knew every morsel of Frisco history when our little mossy burg was such a forgotten cultural backwater? San Francisco had the 49ers and the Golden Gate Bridge and Chinatown and Rice-A-Roni and cable cars. We had Boeing. San Francisco had Redwoods and Berkeley and Steinbeck and Alcatraz. We had Boeing. Okay, now I get why. Seattle was a moody little town nestled under mountains and fir trees and drizzly low maritime clouds. There were lumberjacks around. At least there must have been, with all the trucks of trees proceeding down from the mountains filled with Washington toothpicks. There were fishermen and airplane assemblers and surly wool-clad Scandinavian laborers drinking Rainier beer by the gallon. There, I'll leave it off there.
Rainn Wilson reading from The Bassoon King, his memoir about his life, about acting, about being Dwight Schrute on The Office, about being in Juno. He's also got 4.5 million Twitter followers, and he's one of the creators of a website, a media company, and a book called Soul Pancake. And part of what you're doing with Soul Pancake, as a former philosophy major, I love it, is chewing on life's big questions. So I got to ask you, what of life's big questions have you been chewing on lately?
Oh, man. What am I? Oh, that's a good one. I guess, you know, it's, I would put it as more of a spiritual question. I would put it more in the Thomas Merton camp rather than the Heidegger one. And that is, do we have a purpose? You know, what is my purpose? What do I need to do next? I'm kind of at a crossroads in my life right now. You know, The Office is done, obviously. I tried another TV show, Backstrom, that got canceled. You know, I wrote this book. I might do a play next, but I don't really know what to do next. So it's a kind of a more practical one of what's next? How do I fulfill my destiny? Do we have a destiny?
That's what's fascinating to me. You had two questions. Does life have a purpose? And then what is my purpose? Have you answered the first one and decided that I don't know what it is yet, maybe, but it does have a purpose?
I do believe, as a Baha'i, that God has given us all talents and faculties, and that it really is our responsibility to manifest them to their fullest extent while we're here on this planet. So in that sense, yes, I do. I don't know what that means. That means a different thing for every person. It's for every single person to discover on their own. But I do believe that that is a form of purpose.
Rainn, we asked listeners if they had any good Rainn Wilson stories because
Uh-oh.
You lived here for quite a while.
Oh,
this
no.
is one of the phone calls we got.
Hi, my name is Suzette Rice. You had just asked feedback on Rainn Wilson. He's somebody I grew up with and knew pretty well. He came to a Halloween party at our house a long time ago when we were kids. And it's funny because this last Halloween I had a girl at the house. I live in the same house that I grew up in that Rainn went to a party at. And she was dressed as him, his character, Dwight, from The Office. So it was pretty funny.
Okay. So do you remember that Halloween party at Suzette Rice's house?
I remember Suzette Rice and her sisters, the Rises. They lived out on Bainbridge Island, and they were a Baha'i family, and we used to hang out with them a lot and go hiking and walk on the beach and stuff like that. That was a lot of fun. That's funny.
Well, the funny thing of that story is, are there Dwight Schrute kids' Halloween costumes? That was new to me.
No, you can't go into like a Woolworths and buy a Dwight costume, but it's pretty simple. You just need a mustard yellow shirt with short sleeves and an ugly tie, a brown suit, and, you know, do your hair and your glasses.